In March of 2019, three founders built a SaaS product in 1 week and broadcast it live. Aside from pulling back the curtain of what it takes to get a product from zero to revenue, we also spoke with over 40 awesome founders, investors, and innovators about their experiences and viewpoints. Some are deep, long conversations, while others were quick customer interviews. We're bringing them all to you through the medium of podcasting and hope you enjoy. If you're an early stage founder, you know how important it is to keep your shareholders up to date. Monthly, short updates are super important for your shareholders, but they're also a great tool to keep future investors interested and briefed on your progress. It's more important than ever to stand out, but to also be in control of who sees what. So we built Briefing Room to solve that very issue. Briefing Room provides your shareholders and prospects with simple, beautiful email updates and dashboards that keeps them up to date on your progress. They get pretty dashboards, you get actionable analytics, so you know who's reading, clicking, and spending time on your data. We built Briefing Room in just 1 week, and already it's being used by founders around the world to keep people up to date. Go to briefingroom.co for more information and to start a 2-month free trial. Today we get to hear from Alistair Forbes, a VC and active angel investor from Scotland. I spoke with Alistair about the differences between approaching angels and VCs. We also spoke about how a VC considers an investment and have a little debate on how initial valuation plays into how you're considered by some investors.
Hi, everyone. Thanks very much for joining us. I'm here with Alistair Forbes. Alistair spent the bulk of his career in the IT and software industry and has been involved in starting, scaling, and exiting software companies, as well as having gained experience from less successful businesses of some of the challenges faced by early stage businesses and how to deal with them. Having been an active private investor for several years, he joined Mercia Technologies in December of 2017 as investment director to lead the software and internet sector for the firm, working with the Mercia team to invest in and support high-growth software businesses across the UK. So, Alistair, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with me.
Yeah, my pleasure. Looking forward to it.
So you come from both the kind of angel investing side and now from the venture side. So I can guess maybe this is a more complicated question, but when is a business ready for investment?
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good question. I think certainly either as a private investor or as a VC, I think that what we're looking for is some evidence of some validated assumptions. So, there's all the usual things that an investor can look for in terms of size of the market and, is the product differentiated and all those kind of things and the team. But in terms of when's the right time to be looking for investment, I think we're all keen to see some proof points that demonstrate that, you've got something that's genuinely of interest to people. You've done some testing of it. So, your experiment this week is great because, you're trying to do that in a very compressed timescale. So, it's always much more attractive to invest when you've got some evidence of people starting to engage with the product and that sort of thing.
So you always hear you either bootstrap or you invest. There's no in between, right? Mm-hmm. Which, of course, that's a bit ridiculous. But, at what point, at least from the kinds of businesses that you're both interested in and the ones that you see, Are there trends in terms of how long a company, especially a B2B company, has been bootstrapped for, or are there certain types of, things that you see over and over again that give you an indication as to their stage and when they might be suitable to be able to deliver the kinds of indications that the level of indications that you're expecting?
Sure. So there is a range, obviously. I mean, I think, one of the key determinants of that is, what kind of customer are you targeting? So an SME focused business should be able to get some customers signed up a lot quicker than an enterprise customer. They're generally much more easy. It's much easier for them to take decisions quickly. They're a bit less concerned about supplier risk than a much larger organization. I would have said with an SME type offering, you should be able to get to some reasonable proof points within a few months, really. There's just obviously there's a big debate about, you know, the extent to which you should ship early and learn quickly, or, you know, do you need to have something that is, you know, a gorgeous, compelling finished product? Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's not one right answer, obviously. Whereas I think, you know, if you're looking at an enterprise product, the expectations of enterprise customers in terms of depth of functionality are generally going to be higher. So it's going to take you longer to build the product, you know, to get it into people's hands and to get them to deploy it into their infrastructure. You know, even if it's a cloud-based solution, you know, deploy into their business infrastructure is going to take longer. So, you know, I think the shortest is going to be a few months, but it could easily be, you know, 12 to 18 months before you really start to get that.
And if you're engaging with founders of, let's say, enterprise businesses, and they aren't able to bootstrap to that, you know, that point at which they're, you know, they've secured a couple of enterprise clients, how then do you go through your kind of validation processes of the idea? Is it mostly down to the founders and their backgrounds, or are there other things that you look at from, this is just from an enterprise side, I guess.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Well, certainly the team becomes, you know, you're always investing in a team, but you're kind of even more so if that's always there. So clearly if you have people who have come from the industry and know it really well, have scaled a business before, have got the extensive industry contacts, or even if they've got an advisory board and some private investors who have put some money in, those are all, you know, helpful in terms of validation. Either that they themselves have done it, or credible individuals who have are behind them and supporting them, either in the form of their time or their money to help with that.
Okay. Cool. So in terms of maybe your mind as an angel investor, I guess we can have a different conversation as to whether or not you approach an investment differently as an angel investor than when you're looking at an investment on, you know, on behalf of Mercia.
There's a lot in common. you kind of apply the test of, you know, would you put your own money into this company if you're working for an investment firm? And so, you know, you still have to have, you know, a level of belief in what the company's doing. You can potentially be a little bit less risk averse as a private individual. You know, if you buy into the potential of a company and for whatever reason, either because, you know, it's an area that you've got personal experience of, that kind of thing. So I think, you know, you might perhaps as an angel be investing in something that wouldn't be ready for a VC yet. Mm-hmm. You know, and typically the risk is lower because the check size is probably smaller. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a bit of a difference in that respect. But a lot of the fundamentals in terms of where you see the business going would be similar. You might just be doing it at that earlier stage, and therefore the risk is a bit higher. But, you know, hopefully the return is going to be good as well.
So if you were talking to someone who was thinking about getting into investing, so like they wanted to start being an active angel, it seems like there, this is probably overgeneralizing it, but there seems to be two main camps of people that like to invest into things that they have a background in and they understand quite, whether or not intimately or in to some degree, or they actually prefer to invest in things that they have no idea about. And they kind of prefer that. What would you advise in terms of how someone who maybe wants to start to get into this space, how do they figure out what their thesis is?
Sure. I think looking at things that you don't have personal experience of, you know, I think the sensible thing to do is to place relatively small bets on that. Sure. And, you know, start to get some experience that way. You know, I think if it's an area that you're much more familiar with, then obviously you're going to be more comfortable about your ability to understand the quality of the opportunity, the capability of the team, and that kind of thing. You know, I think whichever approach you take, you know, the advice that I think everybody would tend to give is you need to diversify your risk because it is early stage and there is risk involved. So, you know, don't go too deep into any one thing. So, you know, make sure you've got some sort of portfolio diversification, and that, you know, there's different ways to do that. Either if you're going to be investing directly into companies, then, you know, you're making your own investment decisions. But obviously there are fund structures for private investors that they can invest in the fund, and then the fund is eventually doing the due diligence. And I think that's quite a good way of getting some diversification, because you've got some experienced investors who are managing the fund, and therefore, you know, they've got some rigor around their process. So that helps to de-risk it if it's an area that you don't understand very well.
Sure. So everyone thinks about like deal flow as usually going one way. It's the businesses making contact with the funds, and then you know, it developing that way. But obviously there's the reverse as well. And how, in your experience, whether it's with Mercia or in just observing others, how do institutional investors that have a specific focus, like Mercia with your different focuses, how do you ensure that you're actually getting in front of some of these maybe more exciting or more higher not value in terms of money, but higher value in terms of maybe relationship or level of business? How does the fund side of things actually get in some of those meetings with founders who are in high demand?
Yeah, well, I think it is absolutely essential to be proactive in that regard. You know, any investor who thinks you can just sit back and wait for the good deals to come to you is going to be very quickly disappointed. So, you know, a lot of it is around networks and relationships, either, you know, directly with entrepreneurs or through advisors, you know, sort of professional services people like lawyers and accountants who deal with a lot of early stage companies. And so I think having that presence in the geographic area you want to invest in. So you have to be visible and available in that community in order to be able to be credible. You know, you can't kind of helicopter into an area that you don't know anything about and expect to get lots of good introductions either. So it's very much a thing that takes time to build. And of course, you do get some entrepreneurs who will approach you that, you know, have come direct because, you know, they know that you are an investor who have great businesses. But, you know, that's not a very sustainable strategy for finding deal flow. It's much more important to be out there and be proactive.
Sure. And so just speaking of that, then how does Mercia go about considering deals? Like what is the general process?
You mean in terms of the stages in the process?
Yeah. What happens?
Yeah. So we have a multi-stage process, as you'd expect. So either the business is introduced to us, or we make contact with them if we've been to be flagged up to us. And you know, the initial expectation is some sort of pitch deck that we can have a look at and a business model. I think the days of a lengthy written business plan are long gone. So it does tend to be a lot more based around the pitch deck and the business model. So the first stage would be to have a look through that. We then want to have either a meeting or a call with the entrepreneurs to ask some questions around that, just to make sure that we understand the business properly, and you know, ask some questions about things that we want to dig into a bit more. So that would be, you know, an initial meeting, and at that point, you know, we're investment firms have to triage things pretty quickly, you know, because there's a lot of stuff that comes across the desk. So you know, that initial process has got to be done fairly quickly in order to be efficient, but it's also good for the entrepreneurs as well to get, you know, some quick feedback. You know,
quick no is incredibly valuable.
Yeah, absolutely, and especially if it's backed up with some rationale as to why, you know, it doesn't fit our fund criteria, or it's not a sector, or whatever. So, and especially, you know, if there's somebody. So, for example, we don't tend to invest in marketplace-type businesses, but I know people who do. So, you know, I can very quickly say to somebody, well, it's not really for us, but you might want to go and talk to this other firm. So that sort of thing. So that's the first triage process. Assuming that there is a fit and we're interested, then we want to get into a more detailed discussion with the entrepreneurs and, you know, get into more detail about what sort of the nature of the investment they want is, what their use of funds is going to be, and, you know, test the sensitivities of their model. So you know, we all know that a plan is just a plan. So we want to talk a bit about, you know, what are the risks around that plan? What would you do about them? How would you flex the plan depending on if things are going better or worse or whatever? You know, if at that point we're still enthusiastic, we want to start, you know, talking at a high level about what the terms might look like, to see, you know, are we in the same ballpark? I'm sure you'll have seen, there's a huge range in terms of what we would call realism, what others would call conservatism, perhaps. And it's a negotiation, right? So everybody's going to start off from their own perspective to start with. So again, if that gets to that sort of stage, then for us, the next stage is for us to take that to our investment committee, in the form of just a brief note to start with, to say, you know, from their perspective, is this the right shape and size of deal that we'd be interested in doing, before we get into due diligence and that sort of thing. Again, to make sure that, you know, we're not spending too much of our time or the entrepreneur's time on something that isn't going to go anywhere. So, you know, that process for us, that first stage would happen fairly early on. And that's the signal from the institution, as opposed to the individual investor, that, yeah, this is something that we're interested in. We'd like to get into more detail. And then we're into doing, you know, some due diligence around that. So we want to start talking to potentially some customers, do a bit of management diligence, that kind of thing, and really starting to flesh out, you know, where we think the strengths and the weaknesses of the plan are. Thereafter, you know, we then take all that back to the investment committee for a final sign-off. And thereafter, there's a legal process. So, you know, it's just in talking through that, you can see there are quite a lot of steps. And so, you know, that means it's realistic to expect that from first contact, it's going to be 2 to 3 months, you know, all going well, before investment lands. Well done.
And especially when you're dealing with when you're dealing with founders, let's say of SaaS companies, right? They've reached a point where they're in your ballpark. Probably a certain MRR number, right? They might have never taken investment before, so they might be bootstrapping all the way up until that point. And quite often, founders who are bootstrapping, you know, they may not be a natural kind of, you know, they may be a bit more control motivated than others, and they've never been through that process before. And the whole idea of, in their minds, giving away some part of their business is actually quite difficult. Do you find that is quite an educational piece that you have to kind of is that a piece that you have to educate founders that of otherwise very successful or soon to be successful businesses that there is quite a bit of resistance about, or just in terms of things like valuation, not necessarily from a disagreement in terms of how much you think that you're valued, but just from the fact that they've never been through that process before?
Generally speaking, I think, you know, when people get to the point of having that conversation with an investor, they've kind of made the mental leap to, you know, this is an exchange of value here. So, you know, I'm going to have to give something up in order to get what I'm looking for. Okay. So I don't think that's generally too much of an issue. Okay. You know, to the point earlier, people's expectations around the value of their business can be more or less realistic. And it depends on a whole variety of things, what the right answer is. You know, with a pre-revenue business, we do invest at that stage. We do invest early on, you know, but don't come expecting a multi-million valuation at that point. Exactly. So the education is more around that sort of thing. And it's funny, somebody comes, and we had this just recently, somebody comes to you with what we believe are very inflated valuation expectations. And our feedback is, look, I'm sorry, this doesn't stack up for us. You know, this doesn't work. You know, our valuation expectations would be a lot lower. And we get asked, well, you know, what would that be? And so we threw out another number, and they said, okay, let's talk. Really? you know, it's not very credible in that situation where, you know, you've put out a number that in the market is not going to bear. You know, you've probably been advised rather poorly on that, because to be able to say, right, well, you know, let's talk about a number 8 times lower, which is literally the conversation we had, it's not getting off on the right foot, let's put it that way.
But I mean, again, if you're talking about like especially early stage companies and pre-revenue companies, like valuation is a very subjective thing, right?
So
like
it is, absolutely.
How do you kind of I mean, I don't know what the situation about that company is. They've been running for 10 years and they have this amount of MRR and it's 8 times different. Mm. That's one thing.
Right.
How do you then, like how, is that, is understanding or kind of nailing your valuation and being able to defend it a prerequisite for someone being successful in the world of venture, whereas maybe they might be able to flub it a little bit more or kind of make it up a little bit more in the kind of angel world? That's a very, very, very rambling question, but I hope it made it through.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, there is a narrower range that a professional investor will look at than an angel investor as a rule. And, you know, that's an interesting point as well, because you know, everybody wants to get the right outcome in a negotiation. But it's not just that one transaction that you have to think about. You know, if you are successful in raising money at a really high valuation from whoever the investor is, be it an angel or a professional investor, there is a risk that you're going to find it hard to raise the next round at an increase in valuation. You know, if the valuation you've got
is
that
high.
You know, because that's obviously very bad signaling for anybody that might come along later that, well, actually, you know, they have what looks like a false start. And it may not be.
Yeah.
It's just that, you know, the initial valuation was unrealistic and they've had to reset. So it's about getting the right balance. You know, you want to put your best foot forward in a negotiation and get the best outcome you can. But equally, you know, just be mindful of
reasonable.
what the journey is going to look like, you know, because I talk to various groups about investment and that kind of thing. And you know, one of the things I say is, you know, think very carefully about taking investment, because, you know, be under no illusions, you're getting on a treadmill. And, you know, once you've made that step, you're pretty much committed to that going forwards. And so, you know, be sure that's what you want to do. Because to your point earlier, there are businesses who have been successful with external investment and without external investment. So, you know, there's not a magic formula. You know, I think you can do some research, you know, so you can look on publicly available sources about, you know, what companies have raised money at similar sort of stages. You know, and again, I think, you know, if you're coming in with something that just appears way off beam to an investor, that you kind of ask, well, you know, have you really kind of looked into this and how much have you thought about it? And if the answer is, I'm not sure, then it's, you think, well, what else have you maybe not looked into as much as you should? So it's just a really kind of poor signaling.
So in terms of the areas that you focus on, I know that you're interested in kind of artificial intelligence, cybersecurity, marketing technology, and SaaS. Very large areas. Are there specific kind of trends or developments that you're most excited about in maybe a couple of those areas that that is taking more of your attention now than it would have been, I don't know, a couple months ago?
Well, I mean, just to pick on a couple of those. So the cybersecurity area, you know, that's a market that we see a lot of attraction in, because, you know, the nature of cybersecurity has changed. So, you know, there's always an opportunity when there's that kind of change in the market. There's an opportunity for new solutions. In the realms of software companies, cyber companies can often be in a better position to have defensible IP. Than you would get with many businesses in the software sector. You know, if you look at life sciences, it's pretty much a prerequisite. You've got some patentable IP, but that's relatively uncommon for a software company. But it's actually, cybersecurity is an area where you're more likely to get that, because it's about, you know, algorithms and methods, which you can patent, as opposed to, you know, code, which you can't. So that's interesting. The fact that you see the market is expanding very rapidly. So, you know, if you go back a few years, cybersecurity was something that big organizations worried about. You know, so it was kind of, the analogy is, it's kind of like heavily armed bank robbers attacking large institutions. Yeah. Nowadays, cybersecurity is all about people doing smash and grab raids on corner stores. You know, small and medium-sized businesses are exposed to this. So that's a huge explosion in the market.
Yeah.
The techniques that are used around cybersecurity have changed. You know, it used to be a hard shell approach whereby, you know, you try and keep all the bad guys out. Nowadays, there's a recognition that that's extraordinarily hard to do.
Yeah.
So you need to be looking at, you know, what are the indications of compromise that, you know, it used to be the case that cyber security attacks were often about, you know, a blaze of publicity about the fact, you know, so-and-so has been hacked. The people who really make money out of this stuff, they don't want you to know you've been hacked.
Yeah.
So they don't want to make a song and dance about it. So being, you know, that sort of indications of compromise kind of thing is a whole area. So, you know, all those things mean that, that there's an area with lots of opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the AI space, you know, the first paper that people usually quote about AI research was Alan Turing's 1950
yeah.
scientific paper. So, you know, this is the next new thing that's been around for 60 years.
Yeah. Well, isn't an AI company just slapping AI onto anything, right?
Well, funny you should say that. There are a lot of business plans that come across that have had some AI fairy dust sprinkled on them.
Yes.
AI and but actually have little substance behind them.
Yeah.
But the converse of that is that, you know, there are people who are truly expert in that space, and it doesn't take too long to figure out that that's the case.
Sure.
And you know what's changed in the last 60 years, you know, advances in hardware and algorithms and so on mean that, you know, I think there are a lot more practical applications now. The ability to gather data, to have meaningful data sets on which to work is much increased.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think that again points to increasing opportunity.
Yeah.
So there'll be a couple of examples.
Cool. Any specific portfolio companies that you or companies that you observe that you'd like throw out as examples in terms of showing what good looks like, whether it's in terms of performance pre getting funded,
yep.
or just kind of ongoing?
Sure. Absolutely. So actually, the first company that I'll investment into having joined Mercia is a good example of that. So this is a company in the HR tech space.
Okay.
The things that were attractive in the first instance to me were, first of all, that you know, the founder came from that world. You know, so he had a really deep understanding of the problem space he was working. He had identified an emerging trend in that space. So the move from traditional annual appraisal schemes to more of a continuous performance management type approach. So that's very much a wave that's happening in HR.
Trend,
you know, he had identified that problem space. You know, he generated lots and lots of good content. So, you know, their organic ranking for really quite popular terms was really good. So, you know, that came across as authoritative. They had already got to several hundred thousand of ARR without taking any material external investment.
Yeah.
You know, so that suggests that, you know, they can be capital efficient and they can use money that's invested in them well. So all of that was really positive. And, you know, in interacting with the founder, you got a really good sense of, you know, he's a very mission-driven kind of founder, which is always a good thing in my book, you know, that somebody who has a passion about the problem they're trying to solve, not just about, you know, I want to have a great exit.
Yeah.
So that's a really good indicator. So far, so good. So that's about a year ago now. And they have exceeded the revenue targets. They've spent less than they said they were going to spend, which, you know, doesn't happen often. So when it does, enjoy it. So, you know, they've hired very well, they've built a really good team. They've shown that they can not only win customers, but they can retain them. So, you know, all the kind of indicators from the market and their customers are very positive as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we were having a discussion about, international markets and, you know, it's only when we actually went and looked at the data that they realized that, you know, just what a significant proportion of business they had from international markets as well. So even though they hadn't actively targeted it, you know, they have been able to attract interest from companies out with the UK and been able to convert them as well. So, you know, all of those things, I think, you know, were very positive. So, you know, still
evidence and indications of future, of kind of future growth. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Alistair, for taking the time and to talk with us.
Yeah, my pleasure. And hope the rest of the week continues to go well.
Thank you. Yes. Fingers crossed. Okay.
All right.
Take care.
Thanks a lot. Cheers. Bye. Bye-bye.
That was my conversation with Alistair Forbes. You can find out more about his firm Mercia by visiting www.merciatech.co.uk. Thanks for listening. Coda is a new type of doc that lets entrepreneurs like us grow our businesses on our terms. It feels like your favorite document or spreadsheet tool, but all together in one place. We used it a ton at Zero to Revenue to connect our brainstorming and planning to our event schedule, using it as a single source of truth for all of our activities. And with building blocks like buttons, integrations, and automations, you can really bring Coda docs to life like the apps we would normally have paid hundreds or even thousands to buy off the shelf. Send emails to customers, create automated Slack updates, even pull in the latest weather and stock information. There's no end to what you can build. Coda lets us make the tools we need, the ones that perfectly fit for our process. No coding required. Check out some of our templates and see how you can make Coda apps work for you. Learn more at coda.io. Thanks very much for listening. So what do you think? Share your view on Twitter at Zero to Revenue. Head over to zerotorevenue.com to find all the resources we talked about. And don't forget to join our Slack team for in-depth access to everything we're building.